This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Michael, oh my God, you're on Broadway.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
That's Michael R. Jackson, a 41-year-old composer and playwright. His musical A Strange Loop won the Pulitzer Prize in 2020, and it begins its run on Broadway this month. A Strange Loop is about a man named Usher, who also happens to work as an usher. He's a black queer writer who is writing a musical about a black queer writer who is writing about a black queer writer. Usher sings about the terror of the blank page and the terrors of dating and sex, and all in terms that are quite frank, which we'll hear in some of the clips played in this interview, just so you're aware. Staff writer Hilton Auld's talk with Michael R. Jackson about A Strange Loop.
One of the things that is so extraordinary about this show is that we have never seen anything remotely like it on stage or in a book or in a movie. There's just been nothing like it, Michael. And I wanted to ask you, for the folks out there, what was the genesis of you writing a play about a gay musical theater playwright working as an usher, talking about his life while trying to write a musical about AIDS and among other things?
Well, it started as a monologue initially that I wrote in between graduating from undergrad playwriting and going to grad school for musical theater writing. At the time, I was about 22, 23 years old, and I was just very uncertain of my place in the world and where I would go with a BFA degree.
Where had you studied?
I studied at NYU in the dramatic writing program. Mm. And I had moved. My friend Kisha had been living in this little old lady's house in Jamaica, Queens, and she got a live-in nanny job in Tribeca. So then I moved into the little old lady's house in Jamaica, Queens, all the way at the last stop on the E train and the F train. And then you take a bus from the train to get to her house. And I just lived upstairs in this bungalow-style house. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I don't know what to do. And, like, my student loans were coming due, and my parents wanted to know what I was going to do with my life. And America was about to go to war with Iraq. And I was just, like, just this little black gay boy just sitting, you know, upstairs in this old lady's house. So I started writing this monologue that was about, you know, a young black gay man walking around, you know, New York, wondering why life was so terrible. And just reflecting on lots of whatever was going on in the world at that time.
Yes.
I went to grad school about 9 months later. So I decided to try my hand finally at writing my own song. And the song that came out of that was the song Memory Song, which would end up being the penultimate song in A Strange Loop.
5'4", high school gym, sneaking a cupcake. These are my memories, these are my memories. Shooting hoops.
Well, how long was the process between that monologue and you reaching the stage at Playwrights Horizon?
Oh, it was about 16 years.
Wow.
One lone black gay boy I knew who chose to turn his back on the Lord. One lone black gay boy I knew who chose to turn his back on the Lord.
You shared with me off radio, as it were, your very early love of people like Tori Amos and Linda Ronstadt and all those girls and all those girls who can sing, as they say, but also are writing songs that matter to you a great deal. Do you think that they had a great, or at least a galvanizing influence on your writing music and lyrics?
Yeah, so I will say first that, like, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, Motown. And, like, my parents, you know, are, like, children of, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so that music, like Motown sound, Philadelphia sound, all of that stuff was, and gospel music, all of that was very much a part of my world as a kid and growing up. So that was there. But then, within that, my cousin, Zanita, had gone to Interlaken, and then she got kicked out. But what she brought back was the album Under the Pink and Little Earthquakes by Tori Amos,
yes,
who, for whatever reason, she thought I might enjoy it. And so she gave me her copies of those albums. And so one night when I was about 15, I like decided to listen to Under the Pink. And I turn off the lights, put on my headphones, press play on the Discman, and then the first thing I hear is, "Tears on the sleeve of a man, don't want to be a boy today." And I was like, oh, it's on. Like, it was something about that just, like, reached into my soul. I was just sort of coming out at that time. I was in my most angst-ridden place I could have been as a teenager. And this, like, red-haired, piano-playing white woman just was reading me for filth.
Yeah.
Even though it was her life. It wasn't really about me. But there was something about the way she approached her feelings and her thoughts, the way she ordered her thoughts, the vulnerability, the sexuality, the talking about religion. Because then the next song goes, "God, sometimes you just don't come through." And I was like, you know, black boy raised up in a Baptist church, you know, hearing that, like, being gay is bad and you're going to go to hell and AIDS and all this stuff. And, like, that music, it gave me, like, a real outlet to, like, really start questioning a lot of what I was raised with and under and around and, like, you know, feeling like it was okay to be a weirdo within, you know, my identity category.
I think that one of the things that is so extraordinary about this piece is your freedom in it.
Yes.
You want to give voice to something that I had never seen, and I'm ancient, on stage in terms of not only the artistic process for the protagonist, but also parallel to his disappointment or experiences in the gay world, ideas about sexuality and love. Can you talk to me a bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm from Detroit, and I actually came of age in the mid to late 90s as a gay teenager. But, like, at a time when the world was slowly starting to sort of move toward acceptance for white gay people. But meanwhile, in my little world, there was a whole bunch of black gay boys around me who were all, like, it was like, I always call it the black gay teenage storyline. That it was like this little, like, melodrama happening underneath, you know, behind the scenes. And, like, and I, as I was coming out into that, still felt like kind of an outsider, even within, like, my own category. But then when I moved to New York, it was like things shifted into what in the show is called Gayville. Mm-hmm. Like, exile in Gayville. Of, like, the white gays and, like, trying to orient myself to that.
Usher enters the sexual marketplace.
Looking into hum.
You can do this. You can do this.
In terms of, like, being a black gay who didn't fit in with, like, these white gays for all kinds of physical reasons or racial reasons, whatever, but also competing with other black gays for the white attention, but not measuring up to the black gays competing for the white attention either, and the alienation that came from that at that time as somebody who hadn't found his any sort of confidence or self-love, you know, within his body. Plus, just the baggage of having been raised with a lot of homophobia and shame and all of that, it's all was like swirling in a loop, one might say. And so in the show itself, I just wanted to tackle that and, like, what it feels like to be in the middle of that.
6'2", 179 pounds, muscular, single, packing in the front and in the back, able to take care of all your anal needs. Just say hi.
Looking into Hung.
Undetectable pause bottom, taking loads in the toilet at Lucky Burger on 52nd Street, just steps away from industry and therapy. Come park it right here, gents. Don't be scared. Just say hi.
Looking into
Laid back, nice guy here. No agenda, no drama. Just checking things out. Maybe looking for a gym buddy? Lol. Top, if it goes there. Just say hi.
Hi. Hi!
Too black.
Too black.
Too black.
Your d*** too small.
Your d*** too small.
Your d*** too small.
And when was the last time you got your information with Beyonce?
I would go to the LGBT center to these like really humiliating speed dating events and like not get picked by anyone. And again, it was like a predominantly white thing. And I couldn't figure out like this, like, it was all very confusing.
Too fat and black to live at all. So why don't you just ravage me with your white gay dance savagery?
I mean, one of the things that is profound about the piece, of course, is the way in which you really talk about the white male gay gays and how your protagonist is used to fit uneasily certain kinds of fantasies about black queerness. And I wondered... Was that experience something that you found as dispiriting as your protagonist, or was it something that you felt that you knew that politically was there were the roots were kind of rotten?
You mean for Inwood Daddy?
Yes.
So the Inwood Daddy scene in A Strange Loop is one where Usher, the protagonist, goes to meet an older white man who he connected with on, you know, an app like Grindr or Scruff or something like that. And he goes to his apartment in Inwood in northern Manhattan, and he ends up in a very racist sexual encounter with this man, where this man assumes that Usher is into being degraded racially, and he, like, says a lot of disturbing and racist things to him during sex that Usher does not refute.
Right. He doesn't challenge and then, it.
Right. So that scene and that in my relationship to it is a really interesting one because it's very tricky. That white man in that scene is using Usher, the protagonist, in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
But Usher, the protagonist, willingly participates.
Yes.
In that.
Yes.
And like, and that's part of what the song that he sings after that encounter called Boundaries is about.
Why did I do that? What did that do for me? What a performance. Where are my boundaries?
It's for me, it's too easy to say,
yes,
oh, these white men are like preying on
black boys.
I mean, there's a truth in that for sure. But there's also another piece of it that like somebody comes from a place of desperation, of shame, of low self-esteem, that you will, when you come from that place, you will often subjugate yourself to another person,
yes,
thinking that that will get you validation, love, acceptance, whatever. And then when it doesn't, you know, you have to sit with yourself and like what your part in that was and what their part was in it for sure.
For
but
sure.
Like what your part was in it. And that's certainly something that I've went through in my life, you know, and many times in these kinds of situations, they weren't necessarily as extreme as this, but they sometimes felt like they were.
Down on my hands and knees, why play submissive? What are my boundaries?
Do you think that the piece that A Strange Loop helped you evolve as a person?
Absolutely.
And to let go of certain of the scenarios that are in the piece?
I do, because the thing about it is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I started writing the original monologue as a sort of building a sort of life raft for myself to understand myself. And it wasn't until I got to a place of understanding that in my life, I was caught up in a loop of self-hatred, that I could see what Usher's problem was, and therefore what the structure of the piece was that would lead him out of that and into like a better place. What that meant was, in my own life, that it allowed me to get to like higher ground.
I should stop overthinking and do the thing that's tough. Unleash my hungry lion, 'cause no.
It didn't mean that all my problems went away, but it meant that I could understand my humanity and my selfhood as being something that was not inherently flawed in some way, that I couldn't escape and therefore had to keep trying to fix.
And may the journey never end, Michael, right?
Yeah, you know, the yellow brick road doesn't have to end here. Life is fabulous for ladies after 40.
Yeah. Michael, thank you. You are a treasure.
Thank you, Hilton. I always love talking to you.
Yes, and I'll see you very soon.
Maybe I don't need changing. Maybe I should regroup. 'Cause change is just an illusion. And I is just an illusion. If thoughts are just an illusion.
Michael R. Jackson talking with staff writer Hilton Auls. Jackson's musical A Strange Loop is in previews on Broadway, and it opens on April 26th. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Strange Loop.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jack Antonoff just won a Grammy for Producer of the Year, recognition of his work on albums by Taylor Swift, St. Vincent, and more, not to mention his own music with the band Bleachers. I spoke with Jack Antonoff last summer, and the Bleachers album, Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night, had just come out. It's the music you really want from a Jersey guy. Music you can blast while driving fast down the turnpike. Heavy on the horns and on the big emotions. Stop making this hurt. Say goodbye like you mean it. Stop trying on this hurt. Just say goodbye like you mean it. Say goodbye like you mean it. But it's big and joyous as the music is, Antonoff also describes the album as a heavy one for him in personal terms, and I asked him what was going on while he was writing it.
I spent so much time writing about grief and loss. My sister died when I was 18. It's a very singular experience. It's a tragic experience in my life, and it took me years to realize the space around it, which I think is an interesting trapdoor with trauma. I noticed it with friends, especially if you're young, or, you know, I was 18 as a formative time. It becomes the rug in which everything gets swept under. Everything is, well, your sister died, your sister died, your sister died, or this trauma, this tragedy. And I think this thing happens where you become like sort of a personal genius in one language of grief, but like an infant in everything else. All those years that my friends were examining themselves and their tendencies and their parents, I was just sort of like, anything dark with me is from this trauma. But that's not true. And that's actually a really dangerous place.
To be crude, you mean it was an excuse or a catch-all in some way?
Yeah, it is. And it's this album got really heavy for me because for the first time, I knew I wasn't going to write another batch of songs about grief, because it's something that lives you forever, but I felt like I'd explored it. So then I started exploring all these other things, and this is where, you know.
What did you feel you were exploring in this album?
all the things I missed because I kicked everything under the rug of grief.
And what are we including there?
I mean, not to be too broad, but why I'm this way, my tendencies, the systems in my family that don't work, the ones that do, I came to take the Saturday night because what I started to realize is that there's an evil eye. It might be Jewish, it might be cultural, it might be my specific family. There's a darkness that hangs pretty intensely. And I want more out of my life, and I want to break into the next phase of my life. And that's weird. So I kept seeing this image of a doorway, and there's all this hope and joy on the other side, right? There's all this frustration and anxiety of, like, sometimes it's literal, like, you're holding this bag and it's like, you can't take it all through. It doesn't work. I do not get through this door with all this. I know that. You know, I wrote songs called, like, How Dare You Want More.
Well, I was just going to ask you about this.
Tell me
about that song.
That song came from letting go of some anger towards my parents. Because I found some things out, and when I started to, like, really look at their relationship and our home life and, you know, nothing horrible, but just stuff in which I'm like, God, you put this crap on me and I got to live with it. It's the reason why I have all this trouble. And you know, after some time, I started to say, no, these are human characters who want more, you know. And I'm not talking about money. I'm not talking about a bigger house, obviously. I'm talking about more, you know, more out of your life and the things you really desire. So much darkness wrapped up in that for people. There's no amount of sort of work success that ever makes one feel better about these, like, big rubs in their personal life. They're just separate. They're just separate.
You worked with Bruce Springsteen on one of these songs, and he has talked about, I mean, late in his career, he's talked about battling with depression for year after year and comes and goes, but he didn't really confront it until middle age. Is that useful to you, to talk to other musicians who are older than you, not just about the music, but about the experience of this seeming ideal creative life, successful creative life, and the realities of when you come home from the performance?
Remarkably important to me. I would call it, like, soul saving. Bruce and Patty are incredibly, I've touched on a little bit here and there, but incredibly important figures in my life because, you know, there's a lot of people who have great careers. And there's a lot of people who have really, you know, kind of like great, robustly vulnerable personal lives. There are very few people who can hold both. And if you're out there trying to have both, which I am, which, you know, there's a certain shame that even comes in saying that. How dare you want more? Man, you better find some people to believe in.
Now, we both have to fess up. We grew up in neighboring towns. You a little bit
yes.
after me, of course, you in Wycliffe Lake and me in a town nearby called Hillsdale. And what that turf, which I was, when I was growing up there, which I thought of as terribly boring, couldn't wait to leave, you know, get me to New York as soon as possible. What did that turf give you in your creative life?
Well, I felt the same way. It gave me boredom, which gave me dreams. You know, I always, you know, we're obviously diving deep into a lot of, like, Springsteen culture, but one of the reasons why his work means so much to me is there's a fine line between loving music and hearing yourself and your experience. I mean, when I heard it started with him, he's the architect of it, then it was this local scene and all of the other great music from the shore that I started to discover. You know, first of all, it's the literal landscape. You're hearing streets and places you know, but it's this feeling that there isn't really a word for it. You could say outside the window of the party. You could say younger brother. You could make the medieval comparison, calling the Hudson River a moat. But it's deeper. It's, you know, it's our culture. It's, we are not there, but we are right there. Which is, it's not small town thinking. It's a whole. I mean, let's look at it scientifically. How much energy is coming off of New York City, and then dying as it hits New Jersey? I think we grew up in the sort of, like, metaphorical ash of energy.
All of New Jersey would be thrilled to hear it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, you know, yeah. How much beauty does that create? I, I mean, let's look at New York music, right? Velvet Underground, Strokes, right? Reporting from the center of the world. It's all been there, done that. The first Stroke record when I was younger came out, was called Is This It? Question mark. Mm-hmm. You know, let's compare and contrast Is This It with Born to Run. You know, like, I mean, and it's true in my life. The kids I met, I just wanted to be in the city. I wanted to be a New York City band. I wanted to be around it. I grew up knowing every band that was playing in the city that night and not being able
to go. Yeah.
But it creates darkness and it creates a lot of hope. It creates dreams. There's somewhere to go. It's almost like people who have a very successful father seem to have a tough time. And I feel like growing up in New Jersey, I had nowhere to, and I was lucky. You know, we never worried about food on the table. You could look it up. It's a nice town. We had a nice house. I played t-ball. I went to Jewish school. Like, you know, our worries were not deep. But I never thought that I couldn't outdo my upbringing.
Now, what has stunned me musically about you over time, and is how much music and musical styles you've incorporated into your work as a musician, as a producer. How does that happen? Did you grow up liking music, country music, for example?
Well, yes and no, because I look back. Well, my dad. Interesting story about my dad is a ragtime musician named Reverend Gary Davis.
Guitar player,
brilliant.
And everybody loved getting lessons from him, all kinds of people.
My dad was one of them.
Yeah.
So I think it was Bergenfield, New Jersey. At the time, you could go get a lesson from Reverend Gary Davis, which is crazy.
Unbelievable.
And amazing. So my dad learned in that style, and the style is very specific. It's this sort of fast back and forth picking.
It's really hard.
One sec.
Sure.
Sorry, I'm just grabbing this off the wall.
If you can do this, I'm always impressed with you, but if you can do this, you're my hero.
It's really hard, but this is like, so I'm going to play something really poorly that my dad plays great. It's like this kind of style. Like, hold on. Okay. So it's that kind of, and that's a...
See, if I could do that, I would die happy. Immediately. Yeah.
But then, yeah, so the level, if you see my dad do it, it's a language, this kind of playing. And it flows through you where your thumb is moving back and forth seamlessly and you're picking in between. It's got all these blues undertones and just southern undertones, and there's even like this jazz to it. Long story short, I think it opened this idea of me of just like, oh, like there's different kinds of music, because it wasn't just popular music flowing through the house.
You're known not only as a musician and as a writer, but also as an extremely successful and varied producer working with other people. You've done albums with Lana Del Rey, with Lorde. You've done a lot of this since your last album with Bleachers. At what point did producing other artists really take hold for you?
Well, the funny thing about being a producer, and I've only sort of, I realized this when I was getting into it, like, if you're a songwriter, you can write songs. If you're a performer, you could probably find an open mic night and you might get booed off the stage, but you're a performer. You can't really be a producer unless someone admits that you're a producer. And so I always produced my own records and loved it. But if you do it for yourself, it's a little bit more like, oh, you just kind of make your own records. It's really that lens that someone else sees you through, where they're like, oh, this person can be my producer. And Taylor Swift was the first person who said, we made a song together and I made it sound like everything I wanted it to sound like, and she said, cool, that's that. And that kicked the door wide open.
Jack, one of the collaborations that is really knocked me flat, and it also surprised me when I first heard about it, is you've got a song on the album called 91.
Yeah.
And your collaborator is one Zadie Smith. Tell me
about
that.
That's your world.
So tell me how it came about.
I know Zadie a little bit, and I ran into her near Electric Lady, which is in the West Village. And I'm sure you know Zadie. You know, she's not someone that's like high and by it, sort of like high, and then 5 minutes later, it's like, and that's why this crushing weight is in tow wherever I go. And what do you think of Matcha? You know, it's a sort of, she's a heavy character.
And she can sing, by the way.
She can really sing, and she loves music. So I thought, you know, I work with people who are in music. Zadie's a brilliant writer. I have this song, which I'm having a very, very hard time with. What if Zadie helped me frame it? You just sort of give this unknowing permission where you make space for someone to be like, you know what you could do there? And that was the story with Zadie, and she helped me put it together. She actually sings on a little bit. And the interesting thing about 91 is then I had this mountain with the production. I just could not get that song right. And it ended up being Zadie helping me with the lyrics, St. Vincent coming up with the idea of the strings, and then Warren Ellis, who plays in the Dirty Three and the Bad Seeds, one of my favorite musicians in the world, playing those parts. And it made me feel like this sort of cast of heroes of mine kind of pushing me into the album.
It's 91, no worries on, I'm watching black, white, and green. My mother dances around like there ain't no rip in the scene. While she waltzes with ghosts, I can feel what went wrong. Yeah, she's here, but she's not. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm not. Just like her.
Jack, thanks so much. It's really great talking to you.
Great to see you, David.
That's Jack Antonoff, and we spoke last summer before he received the Grammy Award as a producer. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hey guys, Casey here. Welcome to my channel. Today I'm going to be taking the World's Fair Challenge.
Casey is a girl in her teens. She's sitting in her bedroom, in the dark. Her face is lit by the glow of her laptop. And she looks into the webcam, directly at us, watching this scene. And she says,
I want to go to the World's Fair. I want to go to the World's Fair. I want to go to the World's Fair.
This is a ritual she's read about on the internet. Repeat those words. Smear blood on your screen. Watch a strange video. And something is supposed to happen.
Okay, that was the World's Fair Challenge. Thanks for watching. And I'll make sure to update if I start to notice any changes.
The nature of those changes is the subject of a new film called We're All Going to the World's Fair. It's a horror film, but one that starts with a very real and eerie premise. A lonely and bored kid, spending most of her life online, is trying to figure out just who she is. World's Fair was written and directed by Jane Schoenbrunn. And our producer Alex Barron talked with Schoenbrunn about the long line of movies about the internet, horror and otherwise. Here's Alex.
So movies about the internet, whether they're from last year or from decades ago, tend to be grappling with this question, with this really big question, which is, we made the internet and it got huge and unfathomable and uncontrollable. And so how are we supposed to live alongside it? And over the years, lots of different movies have come at that question from a lot of different angles. So you could think of something like the sort of scary, oppressive cyberspace of a movie like Tron.
Your user can't help you now, my little program.
Or the shiny, happy social internet of You've Got Mail.
Do you think we should meet?
Or quiet, kind of creepy movie about a kid who's trying to use this scary online game to figure something out about herself. And that's what's going on in this new movie, We Are All Going to the World's Fair. And I think that perspective is one of the things that's made me and also a lot of other people really excited about that movie.
So, you want to join the internet's scariest online horror game? We can't be held responsible for what you become. All you have to do to get started is take the challenge.
One of the main goals I set for myself with World's Fair was trying to see how I could evolve the language of how film has talked about the internet to something that felt more true to my version of the internet.
That's Jane Schoenbrunn, the director of We're All Going to the World's Fair. Jane has been making video art and documentaries, often about the internet, for a lot of years, but this is their first feature.
I grew up on the internet. I remember the first computer in the household in the basement. I think it was a Windows 95, and the internet was sort of first there for me as a way to experience culture that I wasn't getting access to as like a 13-year-old kid in middle school in suburbia. and the internet sort of became like a place where I could differentiate myself from my surroundings by, you know, downloading on 56K modem on Napster or whatever, like Neutral Milk Hotel albums and just sort of have access to, I don't think it was community yet. It was more like an outlet towards art that I just wasn't going to find in any other way.
Yeah, it's funny to remember like how hopeful the internet felt when we were younger. Like I had a similar experience to the one you did. Like I grew up in the middle of nowhere and the internet felt like the first access that I had to like a big, interesting world. I feel like for a lot of people I think we're of a similar age, like for a lot of people of our generation, the internet started off from that idyllic place in our lives.
I think it's something that like we don't think about so much because of how dark a place the internet can be in 2022, is that it was sort of just all about desire at first, right? And that was the only reason you were going to be on it, whether you were in an AOL chat room or like an X-Files message board, was I want to learn about this nerd.
And there's nobody around who will talk to me about this nerd. I have to go on the internet to find it.
Yeah. And for me also, like, I'm embarrassed of the corners I was popping into on the internet because I think that they were not traditionally associated with the image that the people in my life wanted to have of me, which was like a 13-year-old boy about to go through puberty, which of course I wasn't. And so in my film, we have access to our main character, a young girl named Casey. She's claiming to be going through the changes that are wrought after you watch this video and complete this challenge. And for me, the fascinating question of the film is how the supposedly horrific changes that she claims to be going through can actually be also viewed as a form of identity play, or at the very least an outlet for her to express a sort of feeling of unreality, or as I would call it, dysphoria.
It's funny, I'd be dreaming. I know I'd be dreaming when it used to happen. But it's like I was also awake at the same time. It was like watching myself on a TV all the way across the room. And I was aware of my actions. Yes, granted, I was aware, but I couldn't control myself. I've been kind of feeling that way recently ever since I watched that video. That feeling's kind of creeping up on me a little bit. I'm not really sure what to do about it.
So in the movie, Casey, the central character, is not explicitly identified as trans. But the way she's using the internet to try to carve out some identity for herself definitely feels informed by Jane's experience as a trans person online. And you can also really tell that when they were making the movie, Jane was really thinking about some of these older movies about the internet. And in fact, to coincide with the release of the movie, Jane has programmed a series of screenings at the Brooklyn Academy of Music of some of those older films that inspired their film.
I would say that they are all movies that can be in conversation with my film in various ways, some aesthetically, some thematically.
The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, the television screen is part of the physical structure of the brain. Therefore,
it's a pretty wild selection of movies on Jane's list. The oldest one is David Cronenberg's 1983 movie, Videodrome.
Your reality is already half video hallucination. If you're not careful, it will become total hallucination.
You'll have to... Videodrome's not actually about the internet. It's, for those who haven't seen it, it's about a TV executive who discovers a pirate TV signal that causes these like horrifying, violent hallucinations in anybody who watches them. So tell me a little bit about how this sort of pre-internet movie ended up in your internet festival.
I think no movie more than Videodrome is about the flicker of the screen and the sort of desire to be lost in it and to have your world changed by it. And I think for Cronenberg, it's almost an inevitability. Our relationship with technologies is inherently somewhat symbiotic, or at the very least, that technology is an extension of ourself, right? Mm. Like, we built it for a reason. We built it because we desire something, and then in turn, it's changing us.
I feel like the thing that you say about Videodrome resonates with a couple other movies in the 80s. I mean, including like Cronenberg's movie The Fly or RoboCop. These are all sort of movies about how technology could warp your physical body.
I would throw out the Donna Haraway essay, The Cyborg Manifesto, which was published in 1985, and is sort of positing exactly this idea, but from an explicitly queer and trans lens, that our bodies can change with technology, and this is going to open up a transhumanist future that, in which ideas of identity and physical form are going to change radically. This would also be around the time when cyberpunk is sort of taking off as a genre. You know, a lot of the 90s internet stuff that I suspect we'll talk about is sort of born from that movement.
There's a new virus in the database.
What's happening?
It's replicating, eating up memory. What do I do?
Type cookie, you idiot. I'll head him off at the pass.
Yes, so by the time we get to the 90s, we are definitely firmly in the cyberpunk world of movies like Hackers and Johnny Mnemonic and, of course, The Matrix. So how is the idea of the internet in those 90s movies different from what we saw in the 80s?
Well, it almost feels like the sort of like dream of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and early Silicon Valley. This was sort of the early dream of the internet, right? That this was a space that by its very nature was going to democratize all communication and sort of like radically change the world into a space without hierarchy, which was obviously, I think time has proven that to be a very adolescent and naive fantasy. But you sort of feel maybe in a lot of those 90s movies, like Hackers, I think, especially, or The Matrix, this idea that the evil corporations are trying to take control of this space, and the true heroes of the internet are the outlaws, right? The people who believe in that mission of equality and democratized information. They sort of become our heroes.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
I think that what, at its heart, my film, We're All Going to the World's Fair, shares in common with The Matrix is the sort of desire to find a space that feels more real than reality, because reality to you feels wrong in this very essential way that perhaps if it's 1998, you can't quite put your finger on. Mm-hmm. It's a film about sort of casting away the shackles of the fake that the corporations have built for us to find our true selves. But it's having that conversation within the context of someone who feels that his life has always felt a little bit like a dream, and like his real life isn't his own. And I think that is an essentially trans feeling.
My God.
I want to jump forward to a movie that's on your list from 2001, a Japanese film called Pulse.
Pulse is kind of the classical there is a ghost in the internet movie. It is about a figure haunting computers and kind of traveling between computers. But so much of the horror in this movie is about entering spaces that maybe feel like real life with something a little bit off and sort of being filled with the dread of realizing that there's something bled of reality in those spaces.
And this is like really the beginning of a healthy seam of movies about ghosts on the internet that came out during the 2000s. But I think one of the things I love about Pulse is that it draws like a thick line between the idea of being lonely and the idea of being on the internet. The spirits, we come to find out, are sort of driven by loneliness. They're seeking out people who are lonely. We get to like a real kind of like emotional place with that movie, which is kind of stunning for a movie that came out about the internet 20 years ago.
It feels very similar to me to what I'm trying to conjure through the World's Fair in my film. Feels very similar to what you're talking about in Pulse. And I think for people who are drawn to the internet, who are actually invested emotionally in that as a space, this is maybe at the center of it. And these are films that are actually interrogating the sort of emotional center of why that space exists and what we use it for.
So over the next couple of decades, obviously, the internet kind of works its way into every element of our lives. So it also works its way into every element of the movies. And now I feel like we've gotten to this place where we're like fixated on the question of where the line should be between the like quote unquote real world and the online world. I'm thinking about movies like Ready Player One or Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle or Free Guy. These movies that seem to suggest that it might actually be good if there was no line for a person to get to be a character in a video game or for a character in a video game to get to be a person.
Or for a boy to get to be a girl. This is sort of the intention of my movie is to not draw like a binary answer, right? Everyone wants to know, do you think the internet is good or the internet is bad? And that's like asking, do you think that people are good or bad? There's not a simple answer to that question. There's a lot of purposeful ambiguity in my film about whether what this person is going through is some form of trying to discover herself through the medium of the internet in a way that's going to have ultimately a positive impact on her real life, even if the expression itself is really dark, or if what we're watching is some kind of like more nefarious manipulation or ghost in the machine kind of thing.
Well, it's been really nice to talk to you through this computer screen.
Yeah, this is where I do all of my talking, like Brian Oblivion. I don't actually exist.
Spoilers for Videodrome.
Filmmaker Jane Schoenbrunn spoke with our producer, Alex Barron. We're All Going to the World's Fair is coming out in theaters and on HBO Max on Friday. I'm David Remnick. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.